something to suit your tastes tonight. I'm easy, I said. Any old rag will do. Marcone narrowed his eyes. There was a short, pointed silence while he met my gaze. He could do that. I'd gotten into a soul gaze with him in the past. It was one of the reasons he scared me. In that case, I would advise you to exercise caution in your acquisitions. Cautious, that's me, I said. You sure you wouldn't rather make this simple? In deference to your limitations, I almost would, Marcone said. But I'm afraid I'm not quite sure what you're talking about. I felt my eyes narrow, and I took a step forward. Susan's hand pressed against my arm, silently urging restraint. I lowered my voice to something between Marcone and myself. Tell you what. Let's start with one of your monkeys trying to punch my ticket in a parking garage. From there, we can move along to the part where I come up with a suitable reply. I didn't expect what happened next. Marcone blinked. It wasn't a huge giveaway. At a card table, only a couple of the players would have seen it, but I was right in his face, and I knew him, and I saw it. My words startled Marcone, and for half a second it showed. He covered it, bringing out a businessman's smile that was a lot better than my fake smile, and clapped a hand gently to my arm. Don't try me in public, Dresden. You can't afford to do it. I can't afford to let you. A shadow fell over Marcone, and I looked up to see Hendricks hulk into view behind him. Hendricks was still huge, still red-headed, still looked vaguely like a defensive lineman, a little too awkward to make it from college to pro ball. His tux was nicer than mine. I wondered if he was wearing body armor under it again. Cujo Hendricks had a date. He had a blonde date. He had a gorgeous, leggy, blue-eyed, elegant, tall, Nordic angel of a date. She was wearing a white gown, and silver flashed at her throat, on each wrist, and on one ankle. I'd seen bikinis in issues of Sports Illustrated that might have felt too plain to be worn by Hendricks's date. She spoke, and her voice was a throaty purr. Mr. Marcone, is there a problem? Marcone arched an eyebrow. Is there, Mr. Dresden? I probably would have said something stupid, but Susan's nails dug into my forearm through my jacket. No trouble, Susan said. I don't believe we've met. No, said the blonde, with a faint roll of her eyes. We haven't. Mr. Dresden, Miss Rodriguez, I believe you both know Mr. Hendricks, and this is Miss Gard. Ah, I said. She's an employee, I take it. Miss Gard smiled. Professional smiles all around tonight, it would seem. I'm from the Monarch Foundation, she said. I'm a consultant. Regarding what, one wonders, said Susan. She definitely had the sharpest smile of those present. Security, Gard said, unruffled. She focused on me. I help make sure that thieves, spies, and poor wandering spirits don't wind up all over the lawn. And I got it. Whoever Miss Gard was, it seemed fairly likely that she was responsible for the wards that had torn Bob up so badly. My head of righteous fury died out, replaced by caution. Marcone had been concerned about my talents. He'd started taking steps to balance things, and Marcone wasn't one to show his hand early, which meant that he was already prepared for trouble of one kind or another with me. He was ready to fight me. Marcone read my features and said, "Neither one of us wants any unpleasantness, Dresden." His eyes became flat and hard. "If you want to talk, call my office tomorrow. In the meantime, I suggest you search for your classic renditions of Elvis elsewhere." "I'll take it under advisement," I answered. Marcone shook his head and walked away to do his own mingling, which seemed to consist mainly of shaking hands and nodding in the appropriate spots. Hendricks and the Amazonian guard shadowed Marcone, never far away. "What a charmer you are," Susan murmured. I grunted. "Such diplomacy." "Me and Kissinger," I scowled after Marcone and said, "I don't like this." "Why not?" "Because he's up to something. He set up magical defenses around his house." "Like he was expecting trouble," Susan said.
"Yeah."
"You think he's the buyer for the shroud?"
"Would make a lot of sense," I said.
He's got enough contacts and money to do it. The buy is apparently going down here, at his gala. I scanned the room as I spoke. He doesn't do anything without planning it out to his advantage. He's probably got friends in hotel security. It would give him all kinds of freedom to meet Valmont where no one was watching. I spotted Marcone as he found a spot near a wall and lifted a tiny cell phone to his ear. He spoke into it, his eyes hard, and he had the look of a man who wasn't listening, only giving orders. I tried to listen in on what he was saying, but between the band, the ballroom, and the chatter of voices, I wasn't able to make anything out. "But why?" Susan asked. "He's got the means and the resources, but what reason would he have to buy the shroud?" "Hell if I know." Susan nodded. "He certainly isn't happy to see you here." "Yeah, something unsettled him, gave him a nasty surprise. Did you see his face?" Susan shook her head. "What do you mean?" "A reaction during the conversation. I'm sure I saw it. He got caught flat-footed when I was talking to him, and he didn't like it."
"You rattled him?"
"Maybe," I said. "Enough to push him into moving early?" Susan's dark eyes had also picked out Marcone, who snapped the cell phone closed and headed for one of the service doors with Guard and Hendricks behind him. Marcone paused to speak to a red-jacketed security guard and glanced in our direction. "Looks like we'd better get moving," I said. "I need a minute to use the spell on this thread sample and lead us to the shroud."
"Why haven't you done that already?"
"Limited range," I said, "and the spell won't last long. We need to be close."
"How close?" Susan asked.
"Maybe 100 feet. Marcone left the room, and the security guard lifted his radio to his mouth.
"Crap," I said.
"Relax," Susan said, though her own voice sounded tight. "These are the upper crust of Chicago. The security guards won't want to make a scene."
"Right," I said, and started for the door.
"Slowly," Susan said, her smile in place again. "Don't rush." I tried not to rush, despite the security guard closing in behind us. I saw red jackets moving in my peripheral vision as well. We kept up the slow, graceful walk of people wandering around a party, and Susan smiled enough for both of us. We got as far as the doors before another red jacket appeared in the doors in front of us, cutting us off. I recognized the man, the gunman outside the television studio, the one who had nearly ventilated Father Vincent and me in the parking garage. His eyes widened in recognition and his hand moved toward his jacket, where a gun would be inside a shoulder holster. The body language was clear. Come along quietly or get shot. I looked around us, but other than the partygoers, the dance floor, and the other security guards, nothing really seemed to present itself as an option. Then the band struck up something a little faster with a syncopated Latin beat, and several of the younger couples who hadn't been dancing previously moved out onto the floor. "Come on," I said, and guided Susan with me.
"What are you doing?" she asked.
"Buying some time to get across the room to those other doors," I said. I turned to her, put one hand on her waist, and took her other hand in mine, and led off onto the dance floor with an uncomplicated two-step. "Just follow." I looked back to her to see her mouth open in shock.
"You told me you couldn't dance."
"Not like in clubs and stuff," I said. She followed me well enough to let me do a little dip and step into a restrained hustle. I don't do so well with rock and roll. Ballroom is something else. Susan laughed, her dark eyes shining, even as she watched the crowd around us for more red jackets.
"Between this and the tux, you're threatening to become classy. Where did you learn?"
I kept us moving down the dance floor, rolling Susan out to the length of our arms, and then drawing her in again. When I first came to Chicago, I had a bunch of jobs, until I hooked up with Nick Christian at Ragged Angel Investigations. One of them was as a dance partner with a senior citizen organization.
"You learned from little old ladies?"
"Tough to tango with someone with lumbago," I said. "It requires great skill." I spun Susan again, this time bringing her back to me with her back to my chest, one hand still on her hip, with the other holding her arm out. There was a subtle electricity in touching her. Her waist slender and supple under my hand, her hair smelled of cinnamon, and her dress left quite a bit of her back naked to view. It was distracting as hell, and when she glanced over her shoulder at me, her eyes were growing heated. She felt it too. I swallowed. "Focus, Harry. See those doors behind the food tables?" Susan nodded. I checked over my shoulder. The security guards had been slowed down by the press of the crowd, and we had beaten them to the other side of the room. That's where we're going. We need to ditch these guys and find Valmont before Marcone gets to her.
Won't security just follow us through the kitchen?
Not if Vanilla Martin diverts their attention before we leave the floor. Susan's eyes glittered, and she kept dancing with me, drawing the tiny cell phone from her clutch.
You have a devious mind.
Call me crazy, but I'd rather not have Marcone's goons walk us out. A little luck came our way, and the band moved to a somewhat slower number. Susan was able to stay closer to me, half concealing her cell phone. I heard the phone dialing numbers, and I tried to still my thoughts and feelings. It hadn't worked for long at the Larry Fowler studio, but if I could rein in my emotions, Susan should at least be able to make a call. It worked. She spoke quietly into the phone for all of 3 or 4 seconds, then clicked it closed and put it away.
2 minutes, she said.
Damn, Martin was good. I could pick out a couple of security guards at the main doors. Marcone's dark-haired hitter was closer. He had trouble making his way politely through the crowd, and we had managed to gain a small lead on him as we danced.
Do we have a signal or anything?
I think we wait for something distracting to happen, Susan said.
Like what? The sudden shriek of breaking tires cut through the band music. There was a loud crunch and the sound of plate glass breaking, along with shrieks from the hotel lobby below. The band stopped in confusion, and people crowded toward the exit to see what was happening.
Like that, Susan said.
We had to swim upstream, so to speak, but it didn't look like anyone was bothering to look at us. I caught a glimpse of Marcone's hitter heading out toward the ruckus. The ass had his gun in his hand, despite any possible field of fire he might have picked, being filled with rich and influential socialites. At least he was holding the weapon low and against his leg. The staff were just as interested in the disturbance as anyone else, and we were able to duck back into the service hallway without comment from anyone. Susan took a quick look around and said, "Elevator?"
"Stairs, if they have them. If someone shoots at us on stairs, we can scream and flail around a lot more."
I spotted a fire alarm diagram on the wall and traced my finger over it.
"Here, down the hall and left."
Susan stepped out of her shoes while I did that. It left her a lot shorter, but her feet were silent on the utilitarian carpet. We went down the hall, found the stairs, and started down them. We went down 3 flights, which put us at ground level again, I guessed. I opened the door from the stairwell and took a look around. A dingy little elevator opened, and a couple of guys in the food-stained white of kitchen hands went walking down the hallway, peering ahead and chattering. I heard a siren or two wailing outside.
"I'll say this for Martin," I muttered. "When he distracts, he distracts."
"He has a strong work ethic," Susan agreed.
"Keep an eye out," I said, and stepped back from the door.
Susan's gaze flicked around the stairwell and over the hallway while I stepped back to kneel on the ground, drawing out what I would need for my seeking spell. I pulled out a black magic marker and drew a smooth circle on the tiled landing all the way around me. The marker squealed as I did, and as I closed the circle, I willed it shut. A gentle barrier, something I couldn't see but could easily feel, closed around me, screening out disruptive forces so that I could work my spell.
"Is that a permanent marker?" Susan asked. "Thus do I strike a blow for anarchy whenever the mood takes me," I muttered. "Just a minute."
I took out the sample from Father Vincent and a wind-up plastic duck, which isn't as goofy as it sounds. Stay with me. I touched the thread to the duck's bill, then wound the duck up. I muttered a low chant, mostly nonsense syllables, and focused on what I wanted. I set the duck down on the floor. But instead of beginning to waddle, it instead waited, completely still. I had to use a rubber band to attach the tiny thread to the duck's bill. It was too short to tie on. I focused, brushing aside any thoughts besides those I needed for the spell, and let the gathered magic go with a whispered, "Seek, seek, seek." The power poured out of me, leaving me a bit short of breath. The little yellow duck quivered and then lurched into motion, spinning about in an aimless circle. I nodded once, reached out a hand, and with an effort of will to support the gesture, I broke the circle.
The screen vanished as quickly as it had arrived, and the little yellow duck quacked and marched toward the door. I glanced up at Susan. Her dark and lovely eyes watched the duck with what could charitably be termed extreme skepticism. I scowled at her.
Don't say it.
I didn't say anything.
Well, don't. She fought down a smile.
I won't. I opened the door. The duck waddled out into the hallway, quacked, and turned to the left. I stepped out, picked the duck up, and said, "It's close. Let's move. We just checked the duck at intersections."
Does the duck know about stairs?
More or less. Come on, I don't know how long the spell will last. I led the way. I'm not the world's mightiest athlete, but I exercise a bit. I have really long legs, and I can walk faster than some run. The duck led us down a pair of long hallways to a door with an employees-only sign on it. I opened the door, peeked in, and reported in a whisper, "Big laundry room." Footsteps sounded behind us, coming down another hallway. Susan looked at me with wide eyes. I pushed into the room, Susan close behind me. I closed the door almost all the way, holding it from closing completely so that the lock wouldn't click and give us away. The footsteps came closer, a couple sets of them, and two shapes went quickly by, passing close to the cracked doorway. "Hendricks and Guard," I murmured to Susan.
"How do you know?" she whispered back.
"Smell the blonde's perfume." I counted silently to 10 and opened the door, looking out. The hallway was clear. I closed the door and turned on the lights. The room was fairly large, with several commercial washing machines ranked against one wall. A bank of dryers faced them on the opposite side of the room, and in between were several long counters that held stacks and stacks of folded white sheets and towels. I put the duck on the floor, and it waddled off down a row of counters.
This is how they had it hidden on the yacht, concealed among laundry. "And those professional thief types tend to be so predictable?" Susan asked.
I frowned and put the duck on the floor.
"Watch the door."
The duck waddled at once over to the far side of the room and bumped into some hanging laundry. I pulled the hanging sheets to one side and found a large ventilation grate behind them. I knelt down, running my fingers and eyes over the edges of the grate, and found a pair of holes where screws had been. A quick tug on the grate headed off the wall, revealing a vent maybe 3 feet square. I stuck my head in and found a ventilation shaft running between the walls. The duck waddled in and took a determined right.
"Air duct," I said.
I twisted out of the tuxedo jacket and absently ripped off the tie from around my neck. I stepped out of the clumsy shoes and rolled up my shirt sleeves, bearing my shield bracelet to view. "Be right back."
"Harry?"
Susan began, her voice worried.
"I saw Alien. I'm not Tom Skerritt."
I winked at Susan, picked up the duck, and entered the air duct, moving as quietly as I could. Evidently, it was very quiet. The duct ran straight, grates opening into utility rooms every 15 or 20 feet. I had gone past 3 of the grates when I heard voices.
"This isn't according to the deal," came Marcone's voice.
It had the scratchy edges of a radio transmission to it. Anna Valmont's smooth British accent answered it from the other side of the next grate.
"Neither was an early rendezvous. I don't like it when a buyer changes the plan."
A radio clicked. Marcone's voice came through it, smooth and calm.
"I assure you that I have no interest in breaking faith with your organization. It isn't good business."
"When I have confirmation of the transfer of funds, you'll get the article, not a second before."
"My factor in Zurich."
"Do you think I'm an idiot? This job has already cost us more than any of us bargained for. Clear off the bloody radio and contact me when you have something worth saying, or I'll destroy the bloody thing and leave."
"Wait," Marcone said. There was tension in his voice. "You can't..."
"Can't I?" Valmont answered. "Don't fuck with me, Yank. And add another million to the bill for telling me my job. I'm calling off the deal if the money isn't there in 10 minutes. Out."
I came up to the grate and found it sitting not quite squarely in its frame. Valmont must have entered the hotel and moved around through the air shafts. I peered out through the grate. Valmont had set up in a storage room of some kind. The only light in the room was a dim green shimmer that rose up from what must have been a palm-top computer. Valmont muttered something to herself beneath her breath, her eyes on the screen. She was wearing a lot of tight-fitting black clothing and a black baseball cap. She wasn't wearing my coat, damn it, but I guess I couldn't have expected to find everything wrapped up in a nice package. I checked the duck, setting it down, facing toward me. It immediately walked in a little circle and pointed toward Anna Valmont. The thief paced the room like a restless cat, eyes on the palm top. My eyes adjusted to the dimness over the course of a few minutes of waiting, and I saw that Valmont was pacing back and forth around a tube with a carrying strap. The tube wasn't more than 5 or 6 feet from me. I watched Valmont pace until her expression and steps froze, eyes locking hard on the palm top. "Great Jupiter's balls," she said quietly. "He paid it." "Now or never." I put my hands on the grate and pushed it as gently as I could. It slid soundlessly from the wall, and I set it to one side. Valmont was focused entirely on her little computer. If the prospect of payment distracted Valmont for a moment more, I'd be able to slip away with the shroud, which would be very James Bond of me. Hopefully the tuxedo would help out with that. I needed only a few seconds to creep out, nip the shroud, and get back into the vents. I almost died when Valmont's radio crackled again and Marcone's voice said, "There, as agreed, plus your additional fee. Will that be sufficient?" "Quite. You will find your merchandise in a storage closet in the basement." Marcone's voice gained an edge. "Please be more specific." I slipped out of the vents, thinking silent thoughts. A long stretch put my fingertips on the tube's carrying strap. "If you wish," Valmont replied. "The article is in a locked room in a courier's tube. The tube itself is outfitted with an incendiary. A radio transmitter in my possession has the capacity to disarm or to trigger the device. Once I am safely on my way from the city, I will disarm the device and notify you via telephone. Until that time, I suggest you do not try to open it." I jerked my fingers away from the tube. "Again, you have altered our agreement," Marcone said. He said it in a voice as smooth and cold as the inside wall of a refrigerator. "It does seem to be a seller's market." "There are very few people able to speak about taking advantage of me." Valmont let out a quiet, bitter little laugh. "Come now, this is nothing more than an entirely reasonable piece of insurance," Valmont said. "Be a good boy, and your precious cloth is in no danger. Attempt to betray me, and you'll have nothing."
"And if the authorities find you on their own?" Marcone asked.
"You'll need a broom and a dustpan when you come for the article. I should think you would be wise to do whatever you can to clear the path for me." She turned the radio off.
I bit my lip, thinking furiously. Even if I took the shroud now, Marcone would be upset when he didn't get his hands on it. If he didn't have Valmont killed, he'd at least tip off the police to her. Valmont, in turn, would destroy the shroud. If I took it, I would have to move fast to get the shroud away from the device. I couldn't count on simply blowing the device out with magic. It was as likely to malfunction and explode as it was to just go dead. I would need the transmitter, too, and there was only one way to get it. I stepped up behind Valmont and pressed the bill of the plastic duck against her spine. "Don't move," I said. "I'll shoot." She stiffened.
"Dresden?"
"Let me see your hands," I said. She held them up, the green light of the palm top showing columns of numbers. "Where's the transmitter?"
"What transmitter?"
I pushed the duck against her a little harder. "I've had a long day, too, Miss Valmont, the one you just told Marcone about." She let out a small sound of discomfort.
"If you take it, Marcone will kill me."
"Yeah, he takes his image seriously. You'd be smart to come with me and get protection from the authorities. Now where's the transmitter?" Her shoulders slumped and she bowed her head forward for a moment. I felt a twinge of guilt. She had planned on being here with friends. They'd been killed.
She was a young woman, alone, in a strange land, and regardless of what happened, she wasn't likely to come out of the situation ahead of the game. And here I was, holding a duck to her back. I felt like a bully.
"My left jacket pocket," Valmont said, her tone quiet.
I reminded myself that I was a professional and reached into her pocket to get the transmitter. She clobbered me. One second I was holding the duck to her back and reaching into her pocket. The next I was falling to the ground with a bruise shaped like one of her elbows forming on my jaw. The light from the palm top clicked out. A small red-tinted flashlight came on and Valmont kicked the duck out of my hand. The beam of the flashlight followed the duck for a silent second, and then she laughed.
"A duck," she said.
She dipped a hand into her pocket and came out with a small silver semi-automatic.
"I was fairly certain you wouldn't shoot, but that goes a step beyond ridiculous."
"I've got to get a concealed carry permit." "You won't shoot either," I said and started to get up. "So you might as well put the gun down." She pointed the gun at my leg and pulled the trigger. Pain flashed through my leg, and I let out an involuntary shout. I grabbed at my thigh as the red flashlight settled on me. I pawed at my leg. I had a couple of smallish cuts, but I hadn't been shot. The bullet had hit the concrete floor next to me and gouged a bite out of the concrete. A flying chip or two must have cut my leg.
"Terribly sorry," Valmont said. "Were you saying something?"
"Nothing important," I responded.
"Ah," Valmont said. "Well, it would be bad etiquette to leave a corpse here for my buyer to clean up, so it seems as though I'll be hand-delivering to Marcone after all. We can't have you running off with what everyone is so excited over."
"Marcone is the least of your worries," I said.
"No, actually, he's quite prominent among them."
"Marcone isn't going to sprout horns and claws and start tearing you apart," I said. "Or at least I don't think he is. There's another group after that shroud, like the thing from the ship this morning." I couldn't see her face from the other end of the red flashlight, but her voice sounded a little shaky.
"What was it?"
"A demon."
"A real demon?"
There was a strained tone in her voice, as though she couldn't decide whether to laugh or sob. I'd heard it before.
"You expect me to believe it was a literal demon?"
"Yeah."
"And you're some sort of angel, I suppose."
"Hell no," I said. "I'm just working for them. Sort of. Look, I know people who can protect you from those things. People who won't hurt you. They'll help."
"I don't need help," Valmont said. "They're dead. They're both dead. Gaston, Francisca, my friends. Whoever these people, these things are, they can't hurt me anymore."
The locked door of the storeroom screamed as something tore it off its hinges and out into the hall. The hallway lights poured in through the gap in a blinding flood, and I had to shield my eyes against them for a second. I could see dim shapes, shadows in front of the light. One was lean and crouched, with shadowy tendrils of razor-edged hair slithering around it in a writhing cloud. One was sinuous and strong-looking, like a man who had traded its legs in on the scaled body of an enormous snake. Between them stood a shape that looked human, like a man in an overcoat, his hands in his pockets. But the shadows the shape cast writhed and boiled madly, making the lights flicker and swim in a nauseating fashion.
"Cannot hurt you any more," said the central shape in a quietly amused male voice. "No matter how many times I hear that one, it's always a fresh challenge."
Chapter 20. My eyes adjusted enough to make out some details. The demonic female with the Joan Jett hair, two sets of eyes, a glowing sigil, and vicious claws was the same Denarian who had attacked at the harbor that morning. The second demonic being was covered in dark gray scales, flecked with bits of rust red. From shoulders to waist, he looked more or less human. From the neck up and the waist down, he looked like some kind of flattened serpent. No legs. Coils slithered out behind him, scales rasping over the floor. He, too, had the double pair of eyes, one set golden and serpentine, the other, inside the first, glowing faintly blue-green, matching the pulsing symbol of the same light that seemed to dance in the gleam of the scales of the snake's head. One little, two little, three little denarians, or so I judged the last of them. Of the three, he was the only one that looked human. He wore a tan trench coat, casually open. His clothes were tailor-fit to him and looked expensive. A slender gray tie hung loosely around his throat. He was a man of medium height and build, with short, dark hair streaked through with an off-center blaze of silver. His expression was mild, amused, and his dark eyes were half-closed and sleepy-looking. He spoke English with a faint British accent.
"Well, well, what have we here? Our bold thief and her..."
I got the impression that he would have been glad to begin one of those trademark bantering conversations all the urbane bad guys seem to be such big fans of. But before he could finish the sentence, Anna Valmont turned with her little pistol and shot him 3 times in the chest. I saw him jerk and twist. Blood abruptly stained his shirt and coat. She'd hit the heart or an artery. The man blinked and stared at Valmont in shock, as more red spread over his shirt. He opened his coat a bit and looked down at the spreading scarlet. I noted that the tie he wore wasn't a tie as such. It looked like a piece of old gray rope, and though he wore it as apparent ornamentation, it was tied in a hangman's noose.
"I do not appreciate being interrupted," the man said in a sharp and ugly tone. "I hadn't even gotten around to the introductions. There are proprieties to observe, young woman." A girl after my own heart, Anna Valmont, had a quick reply. She shot him some more. He wasn't 5 feet away. The blonde thief aimed for the center of mass and didn't miss him once. The man folded his arms as bullets hit him, tearing new wounds that bled freely. He rolled his eyes after the 4th shot and made a rolling, "move this along" gesture with his left hand until Valmont's gun clicked empty, the slide open.
"Where was I?" he said.
"Proprieties,"
purred the feminine demon with the wild hair. The word came out a little mangled due to the heavy canines that dimpled her lips as she spoke.
"Proprieties, father."
"There seems little point," the man said. "Thief, you have stolen something I have an interest in. Give it to me at once, and you are free to go your own way. Refuse me, and I will become annoyed with you."
Anna Valmont's upper lip had beaded with sweat, and she looked from her empty gun to the man in the trench coat with wide, wild eyes, frozen in confusion and obvious terror. The gunshots would bring people running. I needed to buy a little time. I leaned up, fished a hand into Valmont's jacket pocket, and drew out a small box of black plastic that looked vaguely like a remote control to a VCR. I held up the transmitter, put my thumb on it as if I knew what I was doing, and said to the man in the trench coat,
"Hey, Bogart, you and the Wonder Twins back off or the bedsheet gets it."
The man lifted his eyebrows.
"Excuse me?"
I waggled the remote. Click, boom, no more shroud. The snake man hissed, body twisting in restless, lithe motion, and the demon girl parted her lips in a snarl. The man between them stared at me for a moment, his eyes flat and empty, before he said,
"You're bluffing."
"Like the bedsheet matters to me," I said.
The man stared at me without moving, but his shadow did. It writhed and undulated, and the motion made me feel vaguely carsick. His eyes went from me to Valmont to the courier's message tube on the floor.
"A remote detonator, I take it. You do realize you are standing next to the device."
I realized it. I had no idea how big the incendiary was, but that was all right, since I had no idea which button to push to set it off, either.
"Yep. You would kill yourself rather than surrender the shroud? Rather than letting you kill me?"
"Who said I would kill anyone?"
I glared at him and at the demon girl and said,
"Francisca Garcia mentioned it."
The man's shadow boiled, but he watched me with flat, calculating eyes.
"Perhaps we can reach an arrangement."
"Which would be?"
He drew a heavy-caliber handgun from his pocket and pointed it at Anna Valmont. "Give me the remote, and I won't kill this young woman." "The demon groupie headman uses a gun? You've got to be kidding me," I said. "Call me Nicodemus." He glanced at the revolver. "Trendy, I know, but one can only watch so many dismemberments before they become predictable." He pointed the gun at the terror-stricken Valmont and said, "Shall I count to three?" I threw on a puppet's Transylvanian accent.
"Count as high as you want, but you won't get one. One detonator. Ah, ah, ah."
"One," Nicodemus said. "Do you expect me to hand it over on reflex or something? You've done such things repeatedly when there was a woman in danger, Harry Dresden. Two." This Nicodemus knew me. And he'd picked a pressure tactic that wasn't going to take long, however it turned out, so he knew I was stalling for time. Crap. I wasn't going to be able to bluff him. "Hold on," I said. He thumbed back the hammer of the revolver and aimed at Valmont's head. So much for cleverness. "All right," I snapped, and I tossed the remote to him underhand. "Here you go." Nicodemus lowered the gun, turning to catch the remote in his left hand. I waited until his eyes flicked from Valmont to the remote. And then I pulled up every bit of power I could muster in that instant, hurled my right hand forward, and snarled,
"Fuego!"
Fire rose up from the floor in a wave as wide as the doorway and rolled forward in a surge of superheated air. It expanded as it lashed out and slammed into Nicodemus's bloodied chest. The force of it threw him back across the hallway and into the wall on the opposite side. He didn't quite go through the wall, but only because there must have been a stud lined up with his spine. The drywall crumpled in from his shoulders to his hips, and his head snapped back in a whiplash of impact. It almost seemed that his shadow was thrown back with him, slapping wetly against the wall around him like blobs of tar. The snake man moved with blinding speed, slithering to one side of the blast. The demon girl shrieked, and her bladed tresses gathered together in an effort to shield her face as the fire and concussion threw her back and away from the door. The heat was unbearable, an oven-hot flash that sucked the air from my lungs. Backwash from the explosion drove me back across the floor, rolling until I hit the wall myself. I cowered and shielded my face as the scarlet flames went out, replaced with a sudden cloud of ugly black smoke. My ears rang, and I couldn't hear anything but the hammering of my own heart. The fire spell had been something I wouldn't have done if I'd had an option. That's why I had made a blasting rod. Down and dirty, fast magic was difficult, dangerous, and likely to run out of control. The blasting rod helped me focus that kind of magic, contain it. It helped me avoid explosions that left heat burns on my lungs. I fumbled around in the blinding smoke, unable to breathe and unable to see. I found a feminine wrist with one hand, followed it up to a shoulder, and found Anna Valmont. I hauled on her with one hand, found the courier's tube with the other, and crawled for the ventilation duct, hauling them both behind me. There was air in the ventilation shaft, and Valmont coughed and stirred as I dragged her into it. Enough of the storage room had caught on fire that I had light enough to see. One of Valmont's eyebrows was gone, and one side of her face was red and blistered. I screamed,
"Move!"
at her as loudly as I could. Her eyes blinked with dull comprehension as I pushed her past me and toward the opening in the laundry room, and she started moving stiffly in front of me. Valmont didn't crawl as quickly as I wanted her to, but then she wasn't the one closest to the fire and the monsters. My heart hammered in my ears, and the shaft felt oppressively small. I knew that the demonic forms of the Denarians were tougher than either me or Anna Valmont. Unless I'd gotten lethally lucky, they'd recover from the blast, and it wouldn't be long before they came after us. If we couldn't shake them or get into a car, and fast, they'd catch us, plain and simple. I shoved at Valmont, growing more frantic as my imagination turned up images of whipping tendrils cutting my legs to shreds, or venomous serpent fangs sinking into my calves as scaled hands dragged me backward by my ankles. Valmont tumbled out of the air shaft and into the laundry room. I followed her closely enough to make me think of a program I'd seen about howler monkey mating habits. My ears were starting to get their act together, and I heard the high, buzzing ring of a fire alarm in the hallway outside. "Harry?" Susan said. She looked between Valmont and me and helped the woman to her feet. "What's happening?" I got to my feet and choked out, "We need to be gone, right now." Susan nodded at me and then shoved me, hard. I went stumbling sideways and into the wall of drying machines, slamming my shoulder and head. I looked back to see the demon girl's hair pureeing its way out of the vents. And then the rest of the Denarian came out, scales, claws, and all, rolling to all fours with dizzying grace. Fast as the Denarian was, Susan was faster. The demon girl came up with those rich lips split into a snarl, and Susan drove her heel right into them. She kicked hard enough that something crunched, and the demon girl screamed in surprise and pain.
"Susan!"
I shouted.
"Look!"
I was going to say out, but there wasn't time. Half a dozen bunches of tendrils drove at Susan like spears. Susan dodged them, all of them. She had to fling herself across the room to the washing machines to do it, and the Denarian regained her balance and pursued. More blades drove toward Susan, but she ducked to one side, one hand ripping open the door to one of the washing machines. Susan slammed the door down on the demon girl's hair, and without missing a beat, kicked the Denarian's reverse-jointed knee in sideways. The demon girl shrieked in pain, struggling. I knew she was strong enough to pull free of the washing machine before long, but for the moment, she was trapped. Susan reached up and tore a fold-down ironing board from where it was mounted on a nearby wall. Then she spun around and slammed it, edge-on, into the Denarian. Susan hit her 3 times, in the wounded leg, the small of the back, and the back of the neck. The Denarian shrieked at the first 2 blows, and then collapsed into a limp heap at the 3rd. Susan stared down at the demon girl for a moment, dark eyes hard and hot. The ironing board's metal frame was now bent and twisted from the force of the blows Susan had dealt with it. Susan took a deep breath and then tossed the ironing board to one side, straightening her hair with one hand, and commented, "Bitch."
"Wow," I said.
"Are you all right, Harry?" Susan asked. She wasn't looking at me.
"Yeah," I said.
"Wow." Susan walked over to the counter where she'd left her clutch. She opened it, got the phone, and said, "I'll have Martin pick us up at the exit." I shook myself into motion and helped draw Anna Valmont to her feet.
"What exit?"
Susan pointed wordlessly at a fire escape diagram on the wall, still not looking at me. She spoke maybe 12 quiet words into the phone and then folded it shut. "He's coming. They're evacuating the hotel. We'll need to..." I felt a surge of magical energies. The air around Susan grew darker and then coalesced into a cloud of shadows. Within a heartbeat, the cloud deepened, then solidified into a writhing tangle of snakes of all sizes and colors wrapped all around Susan. The air suddenly filled with a sound of hissing and buzzing rattles. I saw the snakes begin to strike, fangs flashing. Susan let out a scream. I turned to the doorway and saw the snake man Denarian standing in it. One not quite human hand was held out toward Susan. His serpent mouth was rolling out hissing sounds, and I could feel the thrumming tension in the air between the Denarian's outstretched hand and Susan. Rage flooded over me, and I barely stopped myself from throwing out another blast of raw spellfire at the snake man. With that much rage behind it, I'd probably have killed everyone in the room. Instead, I reached out to the air in the hallway beyond the Denarian and pulled it all toward him, the words,
"Ventus servitus,"
thundering off my lips. A column of wind hit the snake man from behind, lifted him from the floor, and flung him across the room. He slammed into the wall of washing machines, driving a 1.5-foot deep dent into one of them, and let out a wailing, hissing whistle of what I hoped was surprise and pain. Susan flung herself onto the ground, rolling, tearing at snakes, flinging them away. I could see flashes of her honey brown skin and saw the black dress tearing. Droplets of red blood appeared on the floor near her, on her skin, and on the discarded snakes, but they were hanging on. She was tearing herself apart in her panic to remove the snakes. I closed my eyes for a second that felt 1 year long and gathered together enough will to attempt to disrupt the Denarian's spell. I formed the counterspell in my head and hoped to God that I didn't misjudge how much power I'd need to undo it. too little and the spell might actually get stronger, like steel forged in a flame. Too much, and the counterspell could unleash the power of both spells in a random, destructive flash of energies. I focused my will on the cloak of serpents over Susan and lashed out at them with my power, letting loose the counterspell with a snarled,
"Entropus!"
The counterspell worked. The serpents writhed and thrashed around for a second and then imploded, vanishing, leaving behind nothing but a coating of clear, glistening slime in their place. Susan scrambled away, still gasping, still bleeding. Her skin shone, wet and slick with the residue of the conjured serpents. Rivulets of blood laced her arms and one leg, and thick black bruises banded the skin of one arm, one leg, her throat, and one side of her face. I stared for a second. The darkness on her skin wasn't bruising. It gained shape as I watched, resolving itself from vague discoloration to the dark, sharp lines of a tattoo. I watched the tattoo come into being over her skin, all curves and points, Maori style. It began on her cheek, under one eye, and wound down around her face, around the back of her neck, and on down over one collarbone and into the neckline of her evening gown. It emerged again, winding down along her left arm and left leg, finishing at the back of her hand and over the bridge of her left foot. She hauled herself to her feet, panting and shaking, the swirling designs lending a savage aspect to her appearance. She stared at me for a moment, her eyes dark and enlarged, the irises too big to be human. They filled with tears that didn't fall, and she looked away. The snake man recovered enough to slither his way vertical again, looking around. He focused yellow snake eyes on Susan and let out a surprised wheeze.
"Fellowship," he rasped, the word a hiss. "Fellowship here."
The Denarian looked around and spotted the courier's tube still hanging by its strap from my shoulder. Its tail lashed about, and the Denarian darted toward me. I slipped to one side, keeping a table between us, and shouted,
"Susan!"
The snake man struck the table with one arm and broke it in half. Then he came at me over the pieces, until Susan ripped a dryer out of the wall and threw it at his head. The Denarian saw it coming and dodged at the last second, but the dryer clipped him and sent him sprawling. He hissed again and slithered away from both of us, shooting into the air shaft and out of sight. I panted and watched the vent for a second, but he didn't reappear. Then I hauled the still-stunned Valmont toward the door and asked Susan, "Fellowship?" Her lips pressed together, and she averted her two large eyes. "Not now." I ground my teeth in frustration and worry, but she was right. The smoke was getting thicker, and we had no way of knowing if Tall, Green, and Scaly would be reappearing. I pulled Valmont along with me, made sure I still had the shroud, and followed Susan out the door. She ran along barefoot without breaking stride, and between the pain in my lungs and the blonde thief's torpor, I could barely keep up with her. We went up a flight of stairs, and Susan opened a door on a pair of gorillas in red security blazers. They tried to stop us. Susan threw a right and a left cross, and we walked over them on our way out. I kind of felt bad for them. Getting punched out by a dame was not going to pad their goon resumes. We left the building through a side door, and the dark limo was waiting, Martin standing beside it. I could hear sirens, people shouting, the blaring horns of fire vehicles trying to get to the hotel. Martin took one look at Susan and stiffened. Then he hurried over to us.
"Take her,"
I rasped. Martin picked up Valmont and carried her to the limo like a sleepy child. I followed him. Martin put the blonde thief in and got behind the wheel. Susan slipped in after her, and I slung the tube off my shoulder to get in behind her. Something grabbed me from behind, wrapping around my waist like a soft, squishy rope. I slapped at the car door, but I managed only to slam it shut as I was hauled back off my feet. I landed on the ground near the fire door.
"Harry!"
Susan shouted.
"Go!"
I gasped. I looked at Martin behind the wheel of the limo. I grabbed the shroud and tried to throw it at the car, but something pinned my arm down before I could.
"Get out! Get help!"
"No!"
Susan screamed and tried for the door. Martin was faster. I heard locks click shut on the limo.
Then the engine roared, and the car screamed into the street and away. I tried to run. Something tangled my feet, and I couldn't even get off the ground. I turned to find Nicodemus standing over me, the hangman's noose, the only thing he wore that wasn't soaked with blood. His shadow, his freaking shadow, was wrapped around my waist, my legs, my hands, and it moved and wriggled like something alive. I reached for my magic, but the grasping shadow coils grew suddenly cold, colder than ice or frosted steel, and my power crumbled to frozen powder beneath it. One of the shadow coils took the courier's tube from my numbed hands, curling through the air to hand it to Nicodemus.
"Excellent," he said. "I have the shroud. And I have you, Harry Dresden."
"What do you want?" I rasped.
"Just to talk," Nicodemus assured me.
"I want to have a polite conversation with you." "Blow me." His eyes darkened with cold anger, and he drew out the heavy revolver.
"Great, Harry," I thought. "That's what you get for trying to be a hero. You get to eat a six-pack of 9mm bonbons."
But Nicodemus didn't shoot me. He clubbed me over the head with the butt of the gun. Light flashed in my eyes, and I started to fall. I was out before my cheek hit the ground. Chapter 21. The cold woke me. I came to my senses in complete darkness, under a stream of freezing water. My head hurt enough to make the wound on my leg feel pleasant by comparison. My wrists and shoulders hurt even more. My neck felt stiff, and it took me a second to realize that I was vertical, my hands bound together over my head. My feet were tied too. My muscles started jumping and twitching under the cold water, and I tried to get out from under it. The ropes prevented me. The cold started cutting into me. It hurt a lot. I tried to get loose, working my limbs methodically, testing the ropes, trying to free my hands. I couldn't tell if I was making any progress. Thanks to the cold, I couldn't even feel my wrists, and it was too dark to see. I got more scared by the moment. If I couldn't work my hands free, I might have to risk using magic to scorch the ropes. Hell, I was cold enough that the thought of burning myself had a certain appeal. But when I started trying to reach out for the power to manage it, it slithered away from me. Then I understood. Running water. Running water grounds magical energies, and every time I tried to get something together, the water washed it away. The cold grew more intense, more painful. I couldn't escape it. I panicked, thrashing wildly, dull pain flaring in my bound limbs and fading away into numbness under the cold. I screamed a few times, I think. I remember choking on water while I tried. I didn't have much energy. After a few minutes, I hung, panting and hurting and too tired to struggle anymore, the water only getting colder, bound limbs screaming. I hurt, but I figured the pain couldn't possibly get any worse. A few hours went by and showed me how wrong I was. A door opened, and firelight stabbed at my eyes. I would have flinched if I had been able to move that much. A couple of large, blocky men came through the door, carrying actual flaming torches. The light let me see the room. The wall beside the door was finished stone, but the walls all around me were a mishmash of fallen rubble and ancient brick, and one was made of curved concrete, some kind of piping for the city's water system, I supposed. The ceiling was all rough earth, some stone, some roots. Water poured down from somewhere over me and vanished down a groove worn in the floor. They had taken me to Undertown, a network of caves, ruined buildings, tunnels, and ancient construction that underlay the city of Chicago. Undertown was dark, damp, cold, full of various creatures that shunned sunlight and human company and might have been radioactive. The tunnels where the Manhattan Project had been housed were just the start of Undertown. The people who knew of its existence didn't come down here, not even wizards like me, unless matters were desperate. No one knew their way around down here, and no one would be coming to find me.
Been working out pretty hard, I muttered to the two men, my voice a croak. One of you guys got a cold beer? Maybe a freeze pop?
They didn't so much as look at me. One man took up a position on the wall to my left. The other took the wall to my right.
I should have cleaned up, I know,
I told them.
If I'd have realized I was having company, I'd have taken a shower, mopped the floor.
No answer. No expression on their faces. No nothing.
Tough room, I said.
You'll have to forgive them, said Nicodemus.
He came through the door and into the torchlight, freshly dressed, shaved, and showered. He wore pajama pants, slippers, and a smoking jacket of Hugh Hefner vintage. The gray noose still circled his throat. I like to encourage discretion in my employees, and I have very high standards. Sometimes it makes them seem standoffish.
You don't let your goons talk? I asked.
He removed a pipe from his pocket, along with a small tin of Prince Albert tobacco.
I removed their tongues. I guess your human resources department isn't exactly under siege, is it? I said.
He tamped tobacco into his pipe and smiled.
You'd be surprised. I offer an excellent dental plan.
You're going to need it when the formal wear police knock your teeth out. This is a rented tux.
His dark eyes glittered with something ugly.
Little Maggie's youngest. You've grown up to be a man of considerable strengths.
I stared at him for a long second, shivering and startled into silence. My mother's name was Margaret, and I was her youngest? As far as I knew, I had been an only child, but I knew precious little of my parents. My mother died giving birth to me. My father had suffered an aneurysm when I had been about 6 years old. I had a picture of my father on a piece of yellowed newspaper I kept in a photo album. It showed him performing at a children's benefit dinner in a small town in Ohio. I had a Polaroid instant picture showing my father and my mother, her stomach round with pregnancy, standing in front of the Lincoln Memorial. I wore my mother's pentacle amulet around my neck. It was scarred and dented, but that's to be expected when you run around using it to kill werewolves. They were the only concrete things I had left of my parents. I'd heard stories before that my mother hadn't run with a very pleasant crowd. Nothing of substance, just inferences made from passing comments. I'd had a demon tell me that my parents had been murdered, and the same creature had hinted that I might have relatives. I'd shied away from the whole concept, deciding that the demon had been a dirty liar. And given that Nicodemus and Chauncey worked for the same organization, I probably couldn't trust the Denarian either. He was probably lying.
Probably.
But what if he wasn't?
Keep him talking, I decided. Fish for information.
It wasn't like I had a lot to lose, and knowledge was power. I might find out something that would give me some kind of edge. Nicodemus lit the pipe with a match and puffed on it a few times, washing my face with a little smile on his lips. He read me, easily. I avoided looking at his eyes.
Harry. May I call you Harry?
Would it matter if I told you no?
It would tell me something about you, he said.
I'd like to get to know you, and I would rather not make this a trip to the dentist if I can avoid it.
I glared at him, shivering under the freezing water, the bump on my head pounding and my limbs aching beneath the ropes.
I've got to ask, just what kind of freaking dentist do you go to? Ortho Desaad? Smokin' Joe Mengele, DDS?
Nicodemus puffed on the pipe and regarded my bonds. Another expressionless man came in, this one older, thin, with thick gray hair. He pushed a room service cart. He unfolded a small table and set it up over to one side, where the water wouldn't splash on it. Nicodemus toyed with the bowl of his pipe.
Dresden, may I be frank with you?
I figured the cart would open up to show an array of hardware intended to frighten me with its potential torture applications.
If it's okay with Frank, I guess I don't mind.
Nicodemus watched the valet set out three folding chairs and cover the table with a white cloth.
You have faced a great many dangerous beings, but by and large, they have been idiots.
I try to avoid that whenever I'm able, and that is why you are bound and held under running water.
You're afraid of me, I said.
Boy, you've destroyed 3 rival practitioners of the arts, a noble of the vampire courts, and even one of the fairy queens. They underestimated you as well as your allies. I don't. I suppose you could think of your current position as a compliment.
Yeah, I muttered.